Okay, folks. Hi there. This is Elvin Shamrock here once again, and want to welcome you to our penultimate teleseminar before the first exam starts. Next time we meet will be in 2 weeks, and the exam starts the next day. So we really are in the closing stretch, and I know you folks are all stressed out. But look at it this way. It's almost all entirely behind you. So you should feel good about that. As always, we always have people who are attending our teleseminar for the first time right up to the very end. So for those people who are joining us for the first time, welcome. This is totally unscripted. We have three people who have volunteered cases that they are concerned about, not sure how to defend and how to present them, and I took a quick look at them all before dialing in, and they're all really very good issues for everyone to hear. So being unscripted, I don't know where the conversation will go, although I have an idea of some of the exam-relevant issues that need to be brought up. So with that out the way, we've got three people. One presented themselves as anonymous, so I'm not going to call out his or her name because I don't have it. We've got two others. Lydia, are you there, Lydia? I don't hear Lydia. What about Sedona? Sedona, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, thank you so much and welcome, and I appreciate your submitting your two cases, and so I'm just going to go through these cases as I have them in the email that my secretary sent to me. So let me share with you the first case, which is from Anonymous. But he or she gives the basic clinical presentation, but there's really only one issue that's important to discuss here, and I'll just read to the issue, because a significant percentage of you have this exact issue on your case list, and even if you don't, the discussion points that I'm going to cover are relevant for every single person listening in. It's really an important section. We've touched on this before, but I'll go into it in a fair amount of detail today. So the question that she poses, or he poses, is how do I defend or respond to questioning a case when an abdominal hysterectomy was performed in a 92-gram uterus? Why wasn't minimally invasive approach performed? And the question is totally appropriate. And every single one of you may not have to defend this issue, but you must be prepared to engage in this conversation, because you are expected as OBGYNs to do hysterectomies. So this is a choice that that you have to make in conjunction with your patient, and so you've got to be able to counsel the patient, and you've got to obviously understand what the issues are involved. So look, I'm going to just talk in broad terms, and then I'm going to narrow down the conversation. The general principle is, throughout your exam, and most of you, the vast majority of you listening in, have heard me, have come to our definitive board prep course, you've heard me say this, and it's not going to be new to you, but throughout your exam, you have to continuously push conservatism. If it's in GYN, trying to avoid the surgery, or try to do a less invasive form of surgery. If it's OB, trying to avoid the C-section. If it's office, not over-testing, not bringing them back for redundant, excessive visits. Always be conservative. So in this conversation on hysterectomy, without doubt, the best way to remove the uterus is a vaginectomy. And only if you can't remove hysterectomy vaginally, only then will you go to the next best option, which is a laparoscopic approach. And then within the laparoscopic approach, you've got two options. You've got conventional and then you've got robotic. Generally speaking, the more conservative approach is to go with conventional laparoscopy, and only if there are special needs required or there's special issues relating to a particular case, then absolutely you'd have a low threshold to go to a robotic approach. And finally, the abdominal approach is the approach for all others. When you can't do any of the more preferred routes of hysterectomy. So that's the broad approach. I haven't said anything that not one of you are unaware of this. Every one of you know this. So you never have to defend a TVH. You may have to defend a laparoscopic or an abdominal hysterectomy. Now, the first thing is size. Some of you are worried, concerned. What happens if I'm only comfortable to do maximum a six-week size uterus? Doesn't it look bad, is what you're thinking? And the answer is no, not at all. I truly don't care if your maximum size uterus that you're willing to do from below is 6 weeks or 16 weeks. If it's 16 weeks, fine. It's a feather in your cap. It looks good. You can be proud of it, and that's fine. But from a safety point of view, if your maximum comfort level is 6 weeks, then that's your maximum comfort level. And if it's above 6 weeks, then you will back off to another method, another route. And there's no shame in that, none whatsoever. As long as you always do what's in the best interest of your patient, and you're safe. And safety is the key issue here. So if you're 6 weeks or 16 weeks, it makes no difference. Now, I'm going to give you a model answer of how to handle this conversation. And in it, I'm going to mention a lot of specifics. You may want to jot them down because they are relevant to each and every one of you. So I'm going to play the role of candidate, and I'm going to defend a decision why I did this abdominally. The case that this candidate submitted, he or she states the uterus weighed only 92 grams. So this person feels very bad that the uterus, that the abdomen had to be opened in order to remove this uterus. Now, there were other complicating factors, but I want to go through comprehensively with you what are the issues that one has to take into account. So if the examiner were to ask me, Dr. Shamroth, I see you removed a 92-gram uterus abdominally. Couldn't you have done this vaginally or laparoscopically? That's a totally appropriate question. I would say the following. And folks, I encourage you to use the words that I'm using and speak this way because it shows sincerity, okay? So I would say, you know, I agree. It was really unfortunate that I had to open this abdomen in order to remove a uterus, which really weighed. It was a small uterus. But in my book, every hysterectomy is a vaginal hysterectomy unless contraindicated. In this case, not only was the vaginal hysterectomy contraindicated, but the laparoscopic approach was also contraindicated. These are the factors that I take into account in deciding what is the best route for this patient. Obviously, the size of the uterus is key. And like I said earlier, each of us have our own personal cutoff level, and that's fine. But I take into account the size of the uterus. I also take into account the shape. For example, if she's got two relatively small fibroids laterally, I'm going to be a lot more concerned than if she's got relatively large fibroids on the fundus, because it's not technically challenging like it is if it's low down on the sides. So I take into account the size of the uterus, the shape of the uterus. I look at the possible need, if it's essential, to take ovaries. I look at the past surgical history. Specifically, I'm looking for a history of endometriosis, any history of PID, any history of abdominal pelvic surgery. And by the way, if there are any of those three things, depending on the history plus the clinical exam, it may preclude me from even a laparoscopic approach, depending on severity. So I take into account PID, endometriosis, previous surgery, previous C-sections, and then I also look at the potential need to do other pelvic or intraoperative surgery, and is that possible to do through a vaginal approach. I then also look at the infrapubic angle. If it's a very narrow, acute angle which grips my fingers when I do a pelvic exam, I would tend to be somewhat wary of doing a TVH in that case. Additionally, I look at the vagina, and I'm evaluating it for the length of the vagina and the caliber. If it's a tall, long, narrow vagina, that would be almost impossible to do vaginally, and I would choose another approach. So I take all these factors into consideration. And in this particular case, now notice what I'm coming now to, I'm saying why in this particular case I had to do it abdominally. I would say in this particular case, she had a very narrow, or this patient also had three C-sections, which is a bit of a giveaway. But let's say you had no risk factors, like I've just mentioned. You can say she had a very narrow infrapubic angle, and she had a very long, narrow vagina. Remember, in the exam room, between you and your examiners, you're the only one to examine this patient. They actually can't argue with you. So if you say this, and there's always an element of concern. Sometimes it's mild, sometimes it's more severe. But if you had any element of concern, you can embellish it a little bit and say, you know, I would have loved to have done this vaginally. This would have been a great case, three C-sections aside. But you say this would have been a great case to do vaginally, but for the fact that she had a very long vagina with a very narrow caliber and or a very acute infrapubic angle. So, folks, these are the issues that you need to bring into the conversation and be comfortable to defend them. And you finish off by the same way you started. But at the end of the day, I will always try and do a TVH wherever possible, because I think that's the best way to remove a uterus. So that's the way I would answer that question, and I hope you found that helpful. Okay.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, so is that anonymous? You want to give your first name?
Yeah, no problem. My name is Taki. I'm sorry for tapping in a little late.
No, that's not a problem at all. Thank you very much for supplying this case. It's a great case. Since I can talk to you directly, are you comfortable with how to handle this case now?
I do. And usually minimally invasive is the way that I'd like to go, but in counseling, when I had talked to her about, you know, another, if I go laparoscopically and I'm unable to complete it, I might have to convert to an open procedure. Her reasoning was, well, why don't we just do it open anyway? And that's
conversation piece. And you can always say, by the way, and I didn't mention, I also examine the patient clinically, especially pre-op, to feel for the level of the census.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's, even with three C-sections, if there's tremendous mobility, I might even consider still doing a laparoscopic approach. But if the census is suggestive of significant adhesions, even the entry with a laparoscope, even with an open Hassan's laparoscopy, could be problematic. So this is something else you can add. But keep in mind, no one can argue with you if you use the reason, the indication as a narrow infrapubic angle and a narrow, narrow caliber long vagina. No one can argue with that on those. Okay? So you're comfortable with that then? Okay,
thank you,
great.
Thank you,
wonderful.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sure. Okay, let's try again. Lydia, are you there? Lydia?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, and welcome.
Can you hear
me? Thank you so much for joining. Yes, I can. Very well. Thank you. Lydia, you've got two cases. Let's take the first one first, your GYN case first. Then we'll go to Sedona, and then we'll come back to you for your second case, okay? So you've got a GYN case. All that I've got on the email that was sent to me, pathology did not match imaging and clinical symptoms. No umbilical endometriosis identified on final path. So go ahead and very briefly share with us the case.
Yes, okay, and there's some screenshots to that email, but I'll give you a brief synopsis. This is a 39-year-old, G0. She has a history of chronic pelvic pain, presented to our minimally invasive clinic with some cyclic umbilical pain on top of her chronic pelvic pain, as well as bleeding, actually, from the umbilicus that was happening in a cyclic fashion. With a small area that was like in her, at the base of her umbilicus, concerning for endometriosis given her history. She had a previous intolerance of trying medical management through other physicians elsewhere, kind of scattered different offices, has not tolerated like birth control in the past or any sort of hormonal suppression, and was absolute that she wanted the most definitive management So surgical management was what she had wanted. She did not want hormonal therapy or any sort of for longer term, and had a future desire for infertility. So we did a laparoscopic TLH BSO and excision of this umbilical endometriosis. Let me back up. We did do an MRI, which showed pretty mild potential endometriosis, but did have a small area of nodularity at the umbilicus. So we excised that area, and then on final pathology, she did not have endometriosis at the umbilicus, or did have endometriosis in her ovaries, and then her uterus, which on imaging had shown that she had adenomyosis, didn't have adenomyosis.
The fact that you were suspicious for adenomyosis, and it didn't show, not the end of the world, but it is compatible with what I'm going to suggest. Folks, the principle behind this case is really important to everyone. So, Lydia, let me ask you, first of all, did she have any history of laparoscopy or incision into the navel? Where did that original supposed endometriosis in the navel come from?
Yes. Oh, that's a good question. She did have a cholecystectomy before, so she did have a port site at that location.
Okay.
So one other thing, and I'm sorry.
That is important to add. You mustn't forget that in the presentation. Go ahead. There was one other thing you were going to mention.
I'm sorry. I forgot to mention that because I'm looking at my case list, so I didn't verbalize it. She did get Lupron. We did do 2 months of Lupron preoperatively to bridge her to therapy because she was in debilitating pelvic pain. It was very concerning on exam for endometriosis. So she did get that, and so that's my suspicion is why her pathology didn't show that. But I didn't know if that was enough to say, like, over 2 months, not have any pathologic results.
Let me just respond to that issue. Firstly, while she was on Depo-Lupron, did she bleed from her navel?
It improved. It improved.
Okay. Let me go back. A case like this, you've got to be able to discuss, just list very briefly, the theories regarding the etiology of endometriosis, okay? Because one of them is incisional, okay, which is what I'm guessing mm-hmm. this may be. My question mm-hmm. to you, Lydia, and it's really important that you should be honest with yourself. Do you think that this was a case of endometriosis of the navel?
I believe so. I truly believe so, because I've worked her up in clinic, and the story was so consistent, and the improvement with Lupron. But I was truly surprised there wasn't something that showed up on pathology.
Correct. So I totally agree with you. And I bet you everyone listening in is saying likewise. You've got cyclic bleeding from the navel. That's almost a dead giveaway. But the diagnosis was not picked up on pathology. Let me ask you another question. The adenomyosis, on what basis did you make that diagnosis?
And folks, that was strictly from MRI.
You'll see where I'm going with this. Sorry, that was on MRI. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you answered to my question that I'm going to pose, but I have a rough idea. How accurate, how sensitive is MRI when it comes to diagnosing adenomyosis?
I know it's not the gold standard. I mean, that's gold standard would be pathology.
Correct.
But it can be suggestive. I don't know a percentage.
I'm guessing that it's pretty sensitive. Don't ask me for a number. I would guess 80% if you forced me. But what I'm saying is adenomyosis is one of those diagnoses. Every single one of you can train your pathologist to get a diagnosis of adenomyosis on every hysterectomy virtually. Why? If they take enough cuts, invariably, they will probably find adenomyosis. They're not going to section every millimeter of the uterus. And so it's possible that there is endometriosis, and it was suggested on MRI, but they just missed it when they took the cuts that they took. And what you need to do, just outside of exam prep here, you all need to train your pathologist so that if they don't give you a diagnosis of adenomyosis, they should know that if they don't give you that diagnosis, they're going to get a phone call from you saying this on history and on clinical exam was adenomyosis. Can you take a second look at the specimen and take some more cuts? And if they learn that and get trained that they're going to have to look at a second time at your hysterectomy specimens, they will start taking more cuts ab initio for you. And you'll more times often than not get that diagnosis of adenomyosis. And just by the way, in this particular case, there was a clinical suspicion of adenomyosis, and it was missed by the pathologist. There was also an MRI suspicion. There was also a clinical suspicion of endometriosis of the navel, and it was missed by the pathologist. So I'm being a little harsh now, Lydia, and it's really unfair of me to say this, but I'll say it nevertheless. Do you have confidence in your pathologist, or does he or she not get it right as often as you would like? And the best pathologist is not going to get it right 100% of the time. So it's a little unfair of me to suggest this, but it's a fair question. Do you have the confidence of your pathologist?
Typically, yes. I mean, we're at a large academic center, so there's a lot of trainees
fair
involved,
enough.
And there's a lot of different pathologists. So it could be variable, but typically, yes, we trust.
Okay. So the way to handle this conversation is to be totally, totally open and honest. And you should say in the exam, Lydia, you say, you know, this was a very surprising case because this patient had two diagnoses which did not come up in histology. Number one, there was a clinical suspicion which was supported by MRI that there was an adenomyosis. Now, in that regard, I'm well aware that the gold standard is histology, but it was not detected histologically. And secondly, there was a history which was more than highly suggestive. It was almost pathognomonic of endometriosis of the umbilicus. And I'm wondering in this case, again, maybe the pathologist just cut the specimen and missed the area of endometriosis. It's a possibility, but clinically this was classical umbilical endometriosis. So at the end of the day, I've got to be honest, it was not confirmed on PATH, despite the fact that I do have a strong suspicion that this is what the diagnosis was. And if I were to manage this patient again prospectively, my working diagnosis would be exactly the same. How
that's
does
super helpful
sound to you?
Does that's that super you? Helpful. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's very helpful. I was kind of my larger suspicion was the Lupron, but I think that the fact that the point you made about the different, like truly how a pathology specimen is examined is also really helpful because I don't want to just sit here and say I blame, you know, it's all the Lupron, but I also know that my clinical suspicion was so high and I saw the lesion, I saw the blood stain at the umbilicus, I saw it. So I know that it was
just
so
by
contradictory.
I'm not an REI. But my understanding of Depo-Lupron, it converts the glands, the atopic, or ectopic endometrial glands, it converts them to menopausal proliferative dried out glands, but it doesn't get rid of the glands. It just makes them quiet and quiescent, non-active. But it doesn't get rid of the glands themselves are still there. So, again, I think, and again, I don't mean to be really knocking on the pathologist, especially given what you've said, you're a teaching institution. But at the end of the day, through no fault of his or her own, this is probably what happened. And be comfortable to say it. And be comfortable to conclude with the same way you started. You're convinced this was a case of endometriosis of the umbilicus, okay?
Okay, that's
so
very
are you,
helpful.
Are,
thank
you're,
you.
You're comfortable with that. Good, excellent,
yes,
excellent. Well
thank
done.
You. Thank you. Thank
very
you.
Very nice. Okay, sure. We'll come back to you on your second case. Sedona, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Sedona, okay, great. I understand that you have been an OB case. Go ahead and present the case very briefly to us, and then we'll chat.
All right, so this is a case of a 33-year-old patient. It was her first pregnancy. She had initially presented at 25 weeks and one day with a PPROM, was admitted to the hospital and expectantly managed. And then when I was on call, when she was 28 weeks and 2 days, she started laboring. She was breech, known breech at the time, and so we did an urgent C-section. The C-section was complicated by a bladder dome cystotomy at the time of the C-section. And then unfortunately, this is also a case of a neonatal demise shortly after delivery as well.
Okay, what is your major concern, the cystotomy?
I think both the cystotomy and the demise, but yeah, potentially
sure.
More the cystotomy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, let's just go through, because there's a lot in this case. Number one, you were able to grow this pregnancy by 3+ weeks, from 24 and a half to 28. That's incredible. Okay. So be prepared for discussion on steroids, antibiotics, and preterm labor and tocolysis. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You have a case similar to this in preterm labor or PROM at 23 to 26, 27 weeks, the same applies. How did you counsel this patient in terms of what her options were and what kind of prognosis she can expect for the baby? Keep in mind also, I just want to go through the issues. You don't need to actually answer them. But it's important that you especially and everyone listening are able to answer these questions. Also, if you have to do a C-section, there's a good chance you're going to land up with a classical C-section. So remember to bring that into the conversation as well. Next, you've got to be able to mention the neonatal complications of extreme premature delivery. And I'm talking about NEC, IVH, sepsis, jaundice, retinopathy, there's PDA, there's one or two more, I can't think of them. But you need to be able to list them. And a big question, especially if it's in the 24-week gestational age, are you going to monitor the baby? Because if the mother says, she does not want everything done and she's not willing to undergo a potential classical C-section for a baby that has such a poor prognosis, if that's how she responds to your counseling, then don't monitor the baby because it's not going to make a difference. You're going to go for a vaginal delivery, and you're not going to do a C-section for neonatal indications. So be very, very clear on that, okay? The next point is sometimes it's important to mention a significant negative finding. And in this presentation, Sedona, she lay in hospital for 3.5 weeks with PROM, and she went into spontaneous labor. You then delivered her. You didn't say whether she did have or didn't have chorioamnionitis, and that's what we're expecting to be the precipitant of her labor at 28 weeks. So please mention that one way or the other, because it's a significant issue. So let me just ask you, did she have chorioamnionitis or not?
So there was not clear evidence of it. She did not have a fever. There was no fetal tachycardia or fundal tenderness, with the exception of in the operating room immediately prior to the C-section, the baby's heart rate went up into the 170s, and then on the placenta pathology specimen, there was some evidence of chorioamnionitis on that.
Okay. It's important to mention that because the expectation is that there will be some level of chorioamnionitis. So the next point, and you sort of suggested it now. You know, you watched this baby for 3.5 weeks, and then the baby I see had APGARs of 2 and 1. And died after the first day of life. The baby weighed 1,100 grams. You wouldn't expect that outcome on an 1,100 gram baby. And the average 1,140 gram baby should survive in the vast majority of cases. So you've in your, and folks, this is an issue for all of you. When you've got a case where you have to present a complication or a bad outcome, don't try and skirt around the issue. Rather, take the issue, the bull by the horns, and say up front, if I were you, Sedona, I would say this was a very tragic, somewhat complicated, but tragic case, because at the end of the day, I had a patient where the baby demised on day one of life at a birth weight of 1,140 grams. This is most unusual. That's your opening statement. So you're not, you're being upfront with the examiner. You're showing them, you know, I had a complication and I'm comfortable to talk about it. And you're working on your candidate examiner relationship. And I encourage you in all different scenarios to do this. Don't try and hide from the issue, but show that you're comfortable to talk about it. So, and you know, at the end of the day, and many of you will have this, so Donna, you're going to have to say, and it's totally true, you say in the exam, you know, this was tragic. This baby had terrible APGARs and didn't make it. In retrospect, I wonder whether the degree of chorioamnionitis might have been worse than we understood it to be. Maybe some of the symptoms were masked by the antibiotics that she was on. But in all fairness, the fetal heart rate monitor, at no time until immediately pre-op, showed any evidence. It was a category 1 tracing, or there was no D-cell, there was no tachycardia, there was good beat-to-beat variability. So there was nothing to suggest that there was a problem brewing that portended the final outcome. And I've looked at this case many times, I've discussed it with colleagues. I come to the conclusion, if I were to manage this case again, I would be forced to do exactly the same thing. I think managing this patient prospectively, the management was correct. It was just a very, very unfortunate outcome. So, Sedona, as far as the fetal outcome is concerned, because we haven't spoken about this at the start yet, as far as the fetal outcome is concerned, are you comfortable to discuss it along the lines that I've suggested? Be honest, if you're not,
yeah.
Tell me.
No, I think that's very helpful. Yeah, that's helpful.
I'm guessing the reason why you're comfortable is because pretty much all or most of what I said was in fact what you were thinking and what happened. Am I correct?
Yes. I could just be more forward right away. Yeah, with that.
That's right. The reason why I'm saying this to everyone, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years, and 99% of the time, if you will just, and I'm saying this not just to you, Sedona, but to everyone listening in, if you'll just share openly and honestly with the examiner what you were thinking, why you did what you did, we all make sound decisions. You know, 99% of the time, it's exactly the correct thing to say to the examiner, this is what I was thinking, I would do it again, you know, because the management was appropriate. This is the nature of the territory that we play in, and we're going to get bad outcomes. OBGYN is a terrible specialty when it comes to this. The best OBGYN in town is going to have bad outcomes. We can't help it. It's just the nature of the game that we play. So that's how you handle that one. As far as the cystotomy is concerned, I'm just going to take this case very broadly, and what I'm going to say pertains to anyone and everyone who's got any intra-op complication, especially cystotomy, enterotomy, etc. Number one, again, be totally open and honest, and say when you believe the complication occurred. That's number one. Number two, when in the surgery did you notice it? Because there might be, it might not be at the same time. And sometimes it's only noted post-op. So when do you think it occurred? When did you notice it? And from that point onwards, when you noticed it, what did you do regarding the complication? And I want you, many of you have heard me say this before, I'm going to repeat it. They will not ding you for having a complication. They might ding you, and ding doesn't mean fail, but they will be unimpressed. They might ding you if you don't recognize it in a timely fashion. That's a fair assessment, okay? So when did you suspect it happened? When did you notice it? And from that point, what did you do? Now, and then when it comes to what did you do, you've got to be able to discuss, in this instance, cystotomy repair. And the following questions are all fair game. And just by the way, even if you don't have a cystotomy or an enterotomy on your cases, you can get this as a structured case very easily. It's a beautiful oral exam question. So even if you don't have it on your cases, you need to know this. So how many layers would you close in? What would comprise each layer? Like mucosa and detrusor might be one layer. Serosa might be a second layer. I'm giving an example. So what? How many layers would you close in? What would comprise each layer? What suture material would you use? Vicryl, CatGut, 3-0, number one, I mean, whatever the case may be. And then finally, what stitch type would you use? Would it be continuous? Would it be interrupted? Would it be locking, non-locking? And why? So those are the questions you've got to be able to handle as far as the cystotomy is concerned. And then finally, with respect to any complication, you've got to be able to say, is there any, you don't have to, it's nice to be able to say this, is there anything you took home from this complication that might change the way you do something in the future to reduce the possibility of revisiting this kind of complication? Because that shows you're on a learning curve, you're growing, you're getting better and better all the time. And you can say, you know, as a consequence of this case, I now do the following in a slightly different way. I do X instead of Y. And the thinking is it will reduce my risk of having a cystotomy. Or you can say, you know, I've looked at this case and I've asked myself, is there anything I could do differently in the future if confronted with a situation like this? And I've come to the conclusion, no, I think the way I handled this was correct given the circumstances. And unfortunately, I wish there was, but there's nothing I would do differently because I think the management actually was reasonable. And be comfortable to say whichever one you feel is appropriate. So, Sedona, are you comfortable with that, the cystotomy issue?
I think so, yes.
Excellent. Good. Okay, Lydia, do you have one more? Well, we're running late, but we can finish this last case. Lydia, you've got another office case, I understand. Can you go ahead and present that to us very quickly?
Sure. So this is a 39-year-old who was coming in for like a post-op visit for a TLHBS and adenomyosis.
How old did you say she was? 30, 45, 55?
39, G3, P3, was coming in for a post-op visit, but her main complaint actually was that she has had unilateral milky discharge from her right breast for 6 months, so preceding the TLH. And so the reason she's on my office list is for breast, like under the breast disorders category. She had a normal breast and exam, normal post-op pelvic exam, obtained a breast diagnostic mammogram, which also reflexed to an ultrasound, as well as a prolactin level, which was elevated.
How elevated was the prolactin level? It's one of the few
42.
Times. 42. It's important. 42. Okay.
42.
I'll come back to that. Carry on.
Mm-hmm. And then the only other thing is that was really for the case. We had referred her since this was a postoperative context, and I had started the workup, and her mammogram showed scattered fibroglandular density. Her ultrasound also was consistent with, or probably benign, and then was sent to follow up in 6 months for repeat, which hasn't happened yet. And I sent her for a repeat prolactin. However, she never followed up for that. So that's kind of the part of the workup isn't complete on this, you know, in this presentation,
okay.
But there is
so
still like some things to talk about.
Workup being incomplete, some of you have that issue on your case list, and it's absolutely fine to say
okay.
that the workup was not complete at the time of case list submission. That's absolutely fine.
Okay.
It's nice to be able to verbally give what happened subsequently between submission and taking the exam, if anything did happen. If you can provide that, that's nice. Okay. So at the end of the day, what I'm hearing is the fact that she landed up with a hysterectomy is really inconsequential to the primary issue, which is galactorrhea mm-hmm. with an elevated prolactin. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. And you know, and yes, and the other component to this that I wanted to bring for the session is that it was unilateral. You know, that's what she reported, and
you
know, on exam, that's kind of what I, you know, I witnessed. But it was
so
more speculation.
Let me ask you a question. How surprised or concerned are you that she's got a unilateral galactorrhea in the presence of an elevated prolactin?
I'm not too concerned. I think it's just mostly by report. It was hard. I couldn't necessarily explain it unless maybe we just weren't seeing it from the left breast. But I would typically think
okay.
it would be bilateral.
So that's correct. There are a couple of things that all of you need to know. It's a favorite exam question. Firstly, when you request a patient to go and have a serum prolactin level drawn, you need to tell them it needs to be drawn in the early morning. She needs to be fasting. There can't be any foreplay or nipple stimulation specifically. And she can't do her early morning run and exercise before she goes to the lab, because all of those things can falsely elevate the prolactin level. Okay, that's
mm-hmm.
number one. Number two, what are the points I wanted to make? Just skipped my mind. Yes. The typical lab will give an upper limit of normal for prolactin of about 22, 25, 26 nanograms per ml. It's of that range. That's the upper limit of normal. If you speak to REIs, they will tell you they don't really get plussed or excited unless it's like over 100. So this is elevated above the lab normal, but not elevated significantly to a point where one is concerned for a prolactinoma. So I would say, I don't think this is a prolactinoma, a microadenoma issue, because it would have been bilateral, as you said. Also, the level is only mildly elevated. And I think at the end of the day, as some of the imagery suggested, there might be a bit of excessive glandular tissue. I'm not a maven on breast pathology, so I don't know what kind of breast conditions might be more commonly associated with this, but you can mention one or two, and that's fine. So it's the fact that she didn't come back. You said at the end of the day, I would have very much have wanted, because it was of academic interest as well, clinical interest, I really wanted to know what was causing this. But unfortunately, she didn't come back for her repeat prolactin, which I would love to have seen. And so I don't know what transpired. I think at the end of the day, this was probably something local to the breast. I think it was probably something that would have subsided, possibly. But I don't think it was a threat to her life. But at the end of the day, with any breast pathology, I always want to see them back a second time to make sure that there's nothing, there's no clinical change in the breast over time. And that opportunity was lost to me. How does that sound to you, Lydia?
That sounds good. The one other question is, you know, typically in somebody greater than 30 years old, you would, and this is in the setting of actually feeling a mass, which I didn't, you know, I ordered a diagnostic mammogram, but then they also, I think, it, you know, the radiology department will sometimes add on another study, and they added on an ultrasound as well. Is that anything that they could question me on?
This is a very good question for everyone as well as you. The fact that you, in fact, any of you, you've got the situation on your case, very important to listen up. You know where this typically happens? And a study gets ordered, for example, an MRI or a CT instead of a simple ultrasound gets ordered by the ER, and that's understandable. But the examiner might well ask you, why was this done? And you'll go and say, well, the radiology department recommended it. The next question will be, well, do you think it was necessary? They will still ask you for your opinion. So how will you respond to that, Lydia?
Well, for me, it didn't make too much sense, as in I would have started with a diagnostic mammogram just to see, you know, if there was some hidden sort of mass to explain the discharge. But the ultrasound, I wouldn't necessarily need it in the absence of not seeing a distinct mass or on
clinical exam. That's correct. An ultrasound will just tell you if a mass is solid or cystic. As I understand it, that's it. So the way I would handle that issue if confronted in the exam, I would say, I'm not convinced an ultrasound was necessary, because an ultrasound is really only, as I understand it, warranted when you can feel a mass and you want to know if it's solid or cystic. So I wouldn't have ordered it, but since they did recommend it, and I do have confidence in the radiology department, they're not padding their own pockets, suggesting unnecessary procedures, and I bowed to their superior knowledge in this area. And so I went ahead and went along with it, and it showed X or Y. How does that sound to you, Lydia?
That works. Yeah, I was trying to figure out how to explain why both of those imaging modalities were on my case list, but that actually is helpful. Yeah, I'll use that. Thank you.
Excellent. All right, so folks, listen, these were great cases, because they really are relevant to all of you. And many of you have similar issues on your cases, but the issues that we discuss now can come to you from a structured case. So they were really all beautiful, delicious, juicy exam questions. So I thank all of you for doing this. But before I conclude, folks, this is going to be, as I said, the penultimate teleseminar before the first exam. Can I ask you, again, we do it 3 or 4 times a year. Can I ask you, please, it'll take 20 seconds, do it right away. Send an email to info@exampro.com, info@exampro.com. Just rate this teleseminar on a scale of 1 to 5. 1 is lousy, 5 is excellent. If you want to add additional comments, we really appreciate it. But if you can just, as I say, it'll take you 20 seconds. info@exampro.com, rate the teleseminar 1 through 5. 1 is lousy, 5 is fantastic, and we would appreciate that very, very much. Okay, so if you can do that now, that'll be great. Let me share with you the next teleseminar. Oh, just a word of advice to all of you listening in. Know your tasters very well, obviously, but please practice talking with colleagues, with people that have experience in giving mock orals, with people who are senior to you, so you would feel embarrassed and under pressure to make sure that you didn't give a wrong answer, okay? So practice talking and defending your decisions as much as you can. With that being said, thank you to our three volunteers. Thanks to all of you listening in. Our next teleseminar will be today, 2 weeks, which is the 6th of October. That's a Sunday. I say that knowing full well the next day is the first day of the first week of the exam. I may or may not be speaking with all of you who are taking the exam that Monday. So if I miss you, I want to thank you for joining us in ExamPro and being part of the ExamPro process. We really do feel very strong. It makes a substantial difference to you in terms of your presentation, in terms of how to handle yourself in the exam, and most importantly, in terms of the final results that you can expect. So we'll do this again on October the 6th. And for those of you who are examining October the 7th, all the best of luck. The rest of you, thanks for joining. Again, please fill out that email to us. I'd appreciate it. And that's it. We'll do this again in 2 weeks. Thank you very much, everyone. And this then concludes our teleconference. Thank you so much.